We're going to start the meeting. We don't quite have a forum yet, but this is the assistant commander, Sue, I think, who is a memorized pediatric psychiatrist. So, Dr. Kulik, the chemical dependency, mental health, and SOS.
Good afternoon. I will try to keep this as focused and to the point as we can make it. Before I begin presentation this morning about our budgetary change pages, I just want to make a couple of background comments. I've been the assistant commissioner now for 3 months, and coming into this position, what I have watched in a very painstaking process is an incredible amount of commitment and passion around these programs that our staff has put into this work. Essentially, we have an incredible department and an administration. I am the Assistant Commissioner of the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration. And in that role, one of the things that all of us are involved in is trying to achieve excellence in the state regarding mental health care and addiction care. Just for the record, I just want to quickly review the litmus test that we are trying to apply to all of our programs, which are essentially these 7 goals. Trying to make certain that we are doing our part to eradicate the stigma of mental illness and addictions that exists in our state and across our country, that we are doing what we can to improve access to the right care at the right time for individuals who are needing care, that we are working to establish quality standards of care for mental health and addictions, arriving at appropriate evidence-based strategies and best practices and protocols, that we're integrating care, meaning that we're integrating mental health and addiction care, that we're integrating mental health and addiction care with primary care, that we're integrating with education systems, with employment, with housing, with corrections, law enforcement, and courts, taking advantage of the expertise that we have within the field of mental health and addiction, that we're doing our part to aggressively reduce costs and looking at how we can improve efficiencies, not only in regards to cost, but also in regards to making access to our limited resources as efficient as possible, that we're doing what we can to promote those activities that we know lead to the promotion of wellness and essentially the prevention of mental illness and addiction, and that we are doing what we can to reduce consequences of severe illness. These 7 goals are what I have identified as the goals for our administration. We think through these as best as we can in each of the programs that we currently have in place, and have thought through them to a certain extent in regards to each of these budgetary changes that I'll present to you. Essentially, this is who we are, who we serve. We're individuals across the state. We have 3 policy divisions and state-operated services. This slide right here just demonstrates the administration. It consists of the 3 policy divisions, the Adult Mental Health Division, the Children's Mental Health Policy Division, and the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Policy Division, and also state-operated services. As you know, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program was under this administration prior to my arrival, and it was removed from Chemical and Mental Health Services. I just reiterate that just for your clarification. Within state-operated services, there are multiple levels of care, and just to review those so that it provides some clarity to you when I address specific budgetary changes, state-operated services includes a child and adolescent behavioral level care service, an adult mental health care service, a community and addiction care service, a forensics care service, a neurocognitive care service, which currently will, when I use that terminology, I am referring to our MEDO program as well as our traumatic brain injury program and a lot of our outpatient work with developmental disabilities. And then we also have dental care services. Several of these services I will bring specific recognition to when we're addressing the budgetary change pages. For each change page, I would like to use this format to try to make it as efficient for you as possible. I'll present to you the title slide, which will have the name of the budgetary change page and the page to refer you to. I'll then present 3 slides regarding that page, which summarize first the issue that's being addressed by this change page. The second is the action proposed by the change page. And the third is our review of the potential impacts. And we're well aware that there are some positive impacts and there are some not so positive, if not even negative impacts, in regards to changes proposed. We have tried to take into account as best as we can those factors and the interactions across even other areas of the department and the budget changes that you already have heard. And then I'll open for questions prior to moving on to the next budgetary change page. You guys can change that order as best as you see fit. However, that's what that's how I've arranged the presentation for today.
That sounds good.
So the first change page would be on page number 83, if I can direct you to that. So this is the Children's Mental Health Residential Treatment page. And essentially, the issue being addressed here is trying to arrive at an area of potential cost savings and budgetary savings. Yet we also have an issue of the fact that there has been divided responsibility for children's residential treatment, otherwise known as Rule 5, for kids in our PMAP program. That divided responsibility is between the PMAP plan and also the counties. The other issue is that we do believe across the state there has been inappropriate use of hospital-based services and residential-based services due to alternative lack of lower levels of care that could be much more appropriate given the level of acuity and the level of complexity of the patients that are needing that level of care, specifically partial hospitalization programming. Some of you have heard me speak to the utility of partial hospitalization programming before, and there are some specific actions proposed in this budgetary change phase. So the actions proposed here are to save $5.3 million by delaying the new MA coverage for treatment foster care. This was a program that was initially approved as part of the 2007 Mental Health Initiative, but has not fully gone into effect yet, and there's a potential for savings at this point in time. Our intention is to use $3.2 million of that savings to address the budget deficit, and then to use the balance for three areas. One is to buy out the county share of the Rule 5 for the PMAP kids. The second is to equalize the child versus the adult partial hospitalization rates. And I believe your the information in the change page shows you that there is quite a discrepancy currently between the partial hospitalization rate, that's the per hour rate for children and adolescents compared to adults. Essentially, it's really quite a labor-intensive program to be providing care for a child with complex psychiatric needs in an intensive day program that's not in a locked-secured 24-hour psychiatric unit. And we do believe that discrepancy in the rate has kept providers from trying to open up and provide that level of care that could be more appropriate for their communities. The final thing is to improve the crisis response availability to additional counties that have not opened up that programming as of yet. So the impact proposed with this change is that the Rule 5 buyout saves counties overall about $1.8 million. Of their current investment needs. And then we simplify the administration and therefore assure timely access to the Rule 5 placement. Just to clarify, what happens so often is that there is a barrier to getting admission into a residential treatment program for a child or an adolescent because of the complexity that has to be navigated to get a county approval and a PMAP approval all coinciding at the same time, and trying to get that approval done before that bed availability is lost. So there's a bottleneck that is created often on inpatient psychiatric units, which are much more costly and expensive, and therefore ties up those beds. We see this as something that really has good impact over the entire system of care. And then the final impact proposed is that we do see that can relieve the pressure on inpatient hospitals and the hospitals providing inpatient child or adolescent psychiatric services. I think that is essentially open for any questions, if you all have any thoughts or questions regarding that particular change.
On that last point, that the flexibility, that doesn't save any state money, but it allows more flexibility who even can provide some kind of services. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, to clarify, regarding this slide here, is that the question?
The last of the access less than 24/7.
As far as the access regarding saving money, it's going to probably essentially streamline money by creating a much more efficient process for admissions. If we're talking about the residential treatment for
right.
admissions. Yeah.
Go on to the next page, I guess.
Okay. The next page I'd like to turn your attention to is page number 85. This is the reform payment method for chemical dependency treatment providers. This is...
I could just interrupt for a minute.
We have a quorum now, so I'll call the meeting to order. And Representative Hush, you have two sets of minutes.
I move approval of both of the sets of minutes, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. And I have an announcement. We're going to email you all Dr. Sulik's PowerPoint, so you'll have it.
Thank you. I wasn't aware that you didn't have copies of that in front of you. I apologize if I've been making that assumption. Continuing on, so turning to page number 85, this is the reform payment method for chemical dependency providers. On these title slides, I've tried to highlight for you which one of our divisions this is pertinent to. So this is obviously involving our alcohol and drug abuse policy division. The issue here is there an area here where we could arrive at some potential savings and in improved efficiency, yet at the same time arrive at some statewide or some state-determined rate setting, which has not really happened. What currently is in place is we have 87 counties that are all negotiating with multiple different chemical dependency treatment providers for their rate system. So the variability when we examine this across the state of rates is absolutely incredible. And so this is an attempt to try to arrive at some reform and some structure to how the rates are set, and essentially see that as a potential for savings. Then, so there's a couple things before I move on to the action that we're proposing here. And that one is that there's two additional things that lead to a lot of complications within our state. Providers are not paid differently regarding on the complexity of care of the patient. So what is in this proposal is that we at the department would create a mechanism that uses an assessment of acuity and complexity to try to arrive at a rate system, a rate structure, that would incentivize a provider for providing the care for the more complex patients. Because we see that that is the area of greatest need for us across the state, is to come up with some structure for that. And then finally is that there is some difficulty with getting American Indians access to tribal facilities for chemical dependency treatment, because of a county structure that's currently in place, so there's a proposal within this to arrive at some change regarding that. So the actions that are proposed here is, number one, we would move towards a statewide rate methodology. We would link payment to performance and patient's level of acuity and complexity. And I believe if you look on page 87, that there is a model of what this might look like. That essentially, based on a level of acuity and complexity assessment, you could determine if a patient is really at a low level, a moderate level, or a high level of complexity. And essentially, there would be a different rate structure for those individuals at the high level of complexity compared to the low level of complexity. There are a couple of standardized tools that arrive at this currently. We would propose that in a year process, we would be pulling together stakeholders from across the state, multiple providers and consumers, to try to evaluate those tools or determine if a different tool needs to be put together to help us arrive at that system. The second action is that we would link payment to performance as well as the patient's level of acuity and complexity. So if you imagine this diagram that's up at the top, that there is a rate structure for inpatient based on low, medium, or high complexity. Well, then if a provider has met standards that we have identified that would really achieve which are the level of care and level of standards of care that we propose would really meet the qualification of excellence, that there would be an incentive to pay that provider over and above the current rate set. So there's essentially a pay-for-performance measure built into this rate reform model. As I mentioned, the action would be over the course of the next year. We don't have this developed yet, so we would cap the rates currently, the incredible variance in the rates. We'd cap them at 185% of the current mean. That's an arbitrary figure that we looked at trying to do multiple permutations to determine what would provide the least impact on providers yet arrive at the most reasonable area of cost savings for us. There's about 37 providers that would be impacted as a result that are currently receiving rates above the 185% of the mean. While that is capped, we would be moving towards implementing the structure to arrive at the payment for performance as well as the payment based on level of acuity and complexity. The final action is we would eliminate the county share component for tribal facilities. Again, somewhat like the residential treatment model in children, we'd be removing the county component in the decision-making process, making it much more easier for American Indians to receive chemical dependency treatment on their in their own tribal facilities. The potential impact of this proposal is that it would save $10.9 million in the next biennium. It would help us arrive at more uniform statewide rates. We would achieve more culturally appropriate placements, and after a new rate methodology is in place, we do believe this would help us create incentives statewide to achieve improved outpatient and inpatient clinical outcomes and overall care. The other issue is that we do believe that the incentivizing patients, incentivizing providers to care for the most complex patients improves access to care for those individuals that need access to care probably more than anybody. That is the summary of that budgetary change page. If there's questions on that.
Representative Abler.
Thank you. It's interesting, this is probably the section I know least about of our work, but I just a couple questions and I'll follow up later. But as you would do these different tiers of care, small, medium, large, or easier to more complex, what's going to keep them from upcoding just to do that? Is there going to be an audit or just a self-regulating checklist?
I think that there, in our discussions thus far, it looks like there's models of having audit systems in that. By using a standardized tool, there are some standardized tools currently available that do cover both mental health and addiction levels of care. These usually look at multiple domains. So they don't just look at symptom severity, but they would look at other comorbid factors that would be complicating the individual's condition. They'd be looking at environmental characteristics such as, and it'd be looking at the level of the participation and commitment or motivation of the patient as well as the patient's family. Usually these tools have about six domains over and above just symptoms that are being measured that really help us determine level of complexity. So there's standardized tools that arrive at some inner rate of reliability. But then there typically would have to be some type of a review process, audit process, to make sure that there's not an upcoding by nature in that.
I appreciate that. And is there a problem with access to the higher need people compared to the lower need people? Is that what's going on?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. I mean, our impression is that that seems to be one of the greatest areas of need at this point. Is those individuals that are more complicated to take care of typically have the greatest barriers to getting access to care.
And then the last question.
Representative Abler.
Let me ask questions. Why is the variation in rates so much? Is that some people have a higher, there's not case mix now, they just charge some rates. And it's up to you, if you cap it at 185 of the mean, there must be some people way above that and some obviously way below. Any comments?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, correct. Currently, any individual county could have negotiations. So we have 87 different negotiators out there, each of them negotiating a rate with all the providers that are available. So one provider may have six or eight different rates, depending on which, or maybe more, depending on which counties that they are providing, that they're participating in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Fluid. I have a couple of questions as well. One is, how many, you spoke about culturally specific treatment for folks. Do we know how many providers we have that are offering culturally specific treatment, chemical dependency treatment?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do. So I know those off the top of my head, no, but I can turn around and see if I have an answer as far as number of culturally sensitive providers that see the treatment. We can provide that to you. We do have that information. I just don't have it immediately available.
Good. Okay.
Representative Hayes.
Do we know how many cultures they represent?
Mr. Chair and Representatives, yes. We'll be able to provide that to you. So there are definitely providers who have identified that they are providing care and have some specialty in providing sensitive care for the Hispanic population or American Indian population. So there are multiple providers out there who have identified a very specific area of expertise when it comes to cultural sensitivity.
Chair.
Representative Hayden.
You talked about the difference in scale in terms of how people negotiate their rates with counties. Would say what are the diversity? Would it be folks that are doing co-occurring service or MICD? Would they have a higher rate than say those that are doing outpatient treatment in South Minneapolis? I'm just trying to get the reason behind the difference of rates. If you know that, I know some of the
questions. What I would say is that's our assumption that's probably how some of these rates got to be that, but there's actually no way of determining if that is actually what has gone into the setting of those rates. So there's not a standard. So what you just described, we feel if we apply the standard of level of acuity and complexity measurement to arriving at the rate setting, that it allows us something that we can measure and really determine that the individual who's providing MICD care, obviously, those individuals are more complex. They have more comorbidities, more complexities. They're more difficult and challenging to take care of. And there's going to be probably a greater labor intensity to providing that care and greater level of expertise needed. So we want to incentivize those providers to reach the ability to provide that type of care for those individuals. But right now, although there's some who probably are providing MICD care and probably doing it quite well, we have actually no way of really accurately measuring that that is what has gone into arriving at that rate structure.
Okay. So will you get that information based on surveys that you're going to do in your office, or are you going to go to the counties and try to figure out their methodology of how they arrived at the rates for whatever level of care that that provider gives?
Mr. Chair and Representative, our proposal in this is that we would arrive at that structure. We would provide the tool and require that the tool be done in order to determine which rate somebody could code for and subsequently get paid for based on having completed a level of acuity and complexity scale.
Last one, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
How many of the folks that are receiving service come directly from the drug courts?
Commissioner.
Do we have that? We'll provide that to you.
Okay. Other questions? Seeing none, Commissioner, go to the next page.
I'll bring your attention to page number 89. And this is a proposal to delay new mental health services. This really does impact both the adult mental health division and the children's mental health division. The issue being addressed here is trying to find other areas of potential cost savings to meet the budgetary demands at this time. The action proposed is that we're proposing to save $2.3 million by delaying the new mental MA coverage for adolescent assertive community treatment. This was part of the 2007 Mental Health Initiative. This has not been implemented yet due to multiple reasons for not getting providers to move into this, providing this level of care as of yet. So this is identified as an immediate savings if we delay the implementation of this particular program. The second action is that we would save $750,000 by returning current adult mental health grants under spending back into the general fund. Normally these funds would be reallocated for new mental health services. Both of these were two areas that stood out that we could identify for potential cost savings that kept us from trying to arrive at a reduction across the entire area of grants that we have out. The impact is this avoids across-the-board cuts, as I just mentioned, in adults and child mental health infrastructure grants from 2007 that were all these would have been implemented as a result of the 2007 mental health initiative. Question.
Okay. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the adolescent assertive, that was that supposed to go into effect already, or was there an effective date that is subsequent to right now?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, I believe that it would have gone into effect, but there's been delay,
and
so therefore it's identified as a savings at this point. As far as the reason for the delay, what has been identified as the reason for the delay as of yet, none.
Mr. Chair, John Zockel from DHS. The question was the reason for the delay on the
adolescent. The practical question is, practically speaking, would we be able to implement this program? I mean, there's reasons for the delay we can go into, but are those reasons going to continue so that, it, practically speaking, we wouldn't spend this money anyway?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, that service is currently budgeted to begin May of this year. I believe if we were to focus on this and get our state plan amendments in to CMS, we would be able to achieve that. Now, we've purposely, though, held off on that given the current budget situation.
Representative Abler.
Thank you. The grants that you're recapturing, are those in the hands of counties or individual grantees, or are they a pot of money waiting for money to be drawn out of?
Mr. Chair and Representative, this is a pot of money waiting to be drawn out. So these are grants that have not yet been awarded out, and that's where the decision was. Rather than cutting back on grants that have already been awarded, we've just held off on awarding new grants from the school.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the delay for the sort of community treatment, how many people would be affected by that delay or would not have access to that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we can provide that number to you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge, thank you, Mr. Chair. Even without the specific number, for those who would not have access to the ACT services, what would then happen to them currently? So, I mean, where would they be within the spectrum of services at this moment?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hodge, these are this is targeted towards essentially 15 and 17-year-olds with chronic severe mental illness, individuals with severe bipolar disorder, schizoaffective disorder, early onset schizophrenia. And it's a type of treatment that's really thought of as really being an improvement by being a very mobile, community-based treatment that's very integrated within the community, has a team that can go out to the home. It is believed to be an improvement over current care that may be available, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have current care available to them.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hodge. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. With that current care that may be available to these individuals, could that current care be more expensive than what it would cost to do those sort of community treatments?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge, excellent question. The answer is we believe yes, because what the ACT team really has shown us is that they can prevent hospitalizations, they can prevent emergency room visits. The long-term savings over time is certainly there. The immediate savings by delaying this, when we do an analysis of that, it appears that the immediate cost savings is greater than the immediate savings would be by implementing this now. But our intention is not to move away from the idea of implementation, because this is a treatment model that works and makes a lot of sense.
Representative Bunn. Dean. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, as the statutes are right now, could this money have been available July 1st, 2008 in any form?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'll ask my staff member to address that, because that what would have predated my time here, and I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Chair, John Zockel. The question is, was this money available July 1st of last year? Yes. The adult mental health grant money was available at that time. The adolescent ACT money was budgeted to begin later, though, so it was not actually assumed in the budget at that time to begin back then.
Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, thank you very much for being here today. Question I have for you, it says in the second paragraph under the background that DHS is holding 750,000 of these adult mental health savings. I'm a little bit confused by how you can hold savings. How is it a savings to the state if you're holding it?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe essentially what is being referred to there is that there is $750,000 that has not been granted out yet. So we're holding the RFPs for those and using that money as a cost savings. In other words, we're not intending to spend that money. And that's where that goes into a potential savings in the budget deficit.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sulik, I wanted to continue a little bit with Representative Hosh's question about whether these services would it be replacing what are in fact more expensive services. And I understood what you were saying, I think, about these are immediate savings versus some long term, but in what budget would we find the dollars that this would be replacing, if you understand where I'm going with this? If this would be replacing more expensive services that are being provided right now, where do we see those dollars right now for those more expensive services?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe, as I think about that question, and we can speculate, but I can't actually give you hard data on this, but I can speculate that our saving, that by providing this type of community-based, really essentially a wraparound type of community-based care for those individuals with the most complicated type of mental illnesses and psychiatric disturbances, our goal is that this prevents hospitalization, it keeps people on medication, it prevents emergency room visits, it could prevent community disruptive behaviors that lead to court costs and jail. So the long-term cost savings, I think, have really been well identified with the ACT team model. So if we look at, is this a program we want to not do? Absolutely not. Is this a program that we can justify delaying because it's an improvement of care, but it's not replacing absence of care? That's where that decision went into. I'm not sure if that answers your question well enough.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, where I'm going with this, I guess, Dr. Sulik, because I'm just wondering if it would make sense to shift dollars from some other budget to do this, because, in fact, we're providing care less expensively to perhaps the same people who would be using other care. And maybe that's not a practical thing, but, is there some way that we could look to do that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, question duly noted, and I'm certainly willing to bring back that that question and have us examine if that's a possibility or not. We were charged to come up with as significant areas of savings. This is one area that we could identify that hasn't been implemented yet, and the choice to delay rather than cut costs, cut programs, that was the motivation that went into these decisions at this time.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, are there any matching dollars from the federal government that goes along with this grant?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, yes. It's the usual Medicaid match.
So the one, currently, the one-to-one match.
That's what it currently is, to change soon. The stimulus bill will increase the federal match temporarily.
So so by delaying this, we save money in the general fund. However, we could be also not being able to spend down money that we get from the federal government as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, that's correct.
Okay. And one more follow-up. The other thing that you spoke about, some of the cost savings that would happen in terms of outcomes for folks that are on ACT, it sounded to me like you were talking about adults, jail, et cetera. Have we had some research, or do we understand how adolescent ACT is applied to to young people, which I think might be a slightly different population and maybe some different cost savings. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Commissioner. Mr. Chair and Representative, the ACT teams have been so successful with adults, and this is a real transitional adolescent population that it was assumed that by bringing this down to a lower than 18 age population could allow for improvement in care for that identified higher risk group. It is not widely used at this point at the national level for adolescents as of yet.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
So we don't really know if you're going to have cost savings in terms of school attendance or adolescent psychiatric care or juvenile detention. I mean, let me better ask the question. Do you know of other states that are using Adolescent Act as a practice?
Mr. Chair and Representative, what I can do is do a much more updated search of that and try to provide that information back to you. I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I know we have the stimulus package coming, which can we, my understanding is anything that was in law in 2008 needs to continue, or at least the eligibility needs to continue. And this was put in law in 2008, so even with the stimulus package, could we still not spend this money?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that because of the stimulus package, the governor will be reexamining these pages, and we will have to determine where eligibility needs to be met. And that's the total amount of information I have at this point, Mr. Chair.
Representative Aworth, just brief. So back to the Representative Liebling question and what Representative Hayden was getting at. When we bought this, this was booked as a cost, and there were no savings booked in for decreased other costs, right?
Right.
Thank you so much.
Correct.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to continue with this for another minute. We spent considerable time last session talking about a proposed child and adolescent psychiatric hospital in Woodbury, and we heard an awful lot about the shortage of beds for children and adolescents. And we're just kind of wondering how our eliminating this program plays into that. I mean, from what I'm hearing here, this would hopefully keep some of the children out of those beds. And we heard a lot about how there's no bed available often and kids get sent way away from home and so on. So I'm kind of sitting here thinking that this could have a lot of impact, a lot of them way beyond the financial. But could you just give us a real quick update on that bed issue and, you know, what happens right now when, you know, one of these kids has a crisis?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative. Excellent series of questions. And I think what I can tell you is that I presented previously a potential savings where we want to take a portion of that savings and rise the rate for partial hospitalization programs to incentivize providers to provide outpatient partial hospitalization programming, because we really do identify that that is probably one of the most significant things to prevent hospitalization, is having that service available. So if I had to make a choice between the two at this point in time, in a very time-limited manner, I would try to get the partial hospitalizations in place as quickly as I could. The ACT teams are really a significant improvement over care, but for a smaller portion of the population who would still be eligible and have access to partial hospitalization programs. And so that's really part of the broader way of thinking about as we've had to think through this. In regards to the bed shortage dilemma, it's really, as I mentioned last night at the Mental Health Caucus meeting, we have a shortage of child and adolescent psychiatrists. Because of a shortage of child and adolescent psychiatrists, we have an access to care issue across the state. And access to care, we can't rely solely on inpatient beds available. We have to rely on the array of services that need to be available. Partial hospitalization being one of them, inpatient being one of them, appropriate access to residential care being one of them, ACT teams being one of them. So again, I'm not making a judgment about ACT team versus other services. Just, I'm trying to help explain some of the decision making and the thought processes that went into trying to decide which could be delayed at this point in time.
When Mike Hatch was Attorney General, he sued somebody, I'm not quite remembering, and weren't whoever he sued, maybe with the health plans, I don't know, weren't they supposed to set up exactly these kinds of beds?
Mr. Chair, that might have predated my time coming to
Minnesota.
Yeah, I know
that.
from what I recall, I think it has to do mostly with eating disorder programs. That's the suit that I'm most familiar with, but somebody can certainly be bringing me more information if there's something more accurate in regards to it. Otherwise, I can certainly...
Why don't we just move ahead then?
Okay.
Representative Hayden.
I just have one last question. Do we have any other kind of mobile teams, like, you know, targeted case management or any of that for adolescents? Do we provide that service at all? I know we do for adults. Targeted case management, other kind of mental health services that actually case management services.
But, Mr. Chair and Representative, the targeted case management proposal would be adolescents would be eligible for that as well as adults, is my understanding. And we do have that in place at this point in time. We're currently going through some negotiations with counties.
I don't see any other questions. No other questions, so let's continue.
I'll bring your attention to page number 91. Mr. Chair, I just want to, if I could clarify a statement I made earlier, just so that it's clear regarding the CD rates. This, I think, makes sense to clarify. Each chemical dependency provider contracts with one county, and then all the counties have to honor that particular rate and so don't have the ability. So it provides even more local subjectivity to the rate. But I said that every county contracts with every provider. It's every provider contracts with one county, and then the rest of the counties have to honor that particular rate that's been negotiated. Continuing with page number 91, this particular budgetary change page, I'm well aware is controversial, and I just want to provide as much background information to the thought process on this as possible. This is in regards to, our Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. The issue here is, can we arrive at two things? Can we arrive at an area of reducing the amount of money spent currently in grants awarded out of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division? And is there a way to provide a better standardization to a competitive process so that all grants are awarded with the exact same structure? Currently, we have certain CD grants that are designated for specific providers based on legislative direction. All the other CD grants are allocated based on RFPs and having to go through a competitive review process in order to be awarded the grant. So what is proposed here is to save $1 million by eliminating CD grants which have been awarded through this legislative designation. So I just want to clarify, it says narrow focus on the slide. What is meant there is eliminating the CD grants that have been awarded through this legislative focus rather than going through the competitive process. So effective 1-1 of 2010, we would eliminate state DHS funds for two different grant programs that have gone through this designation. What I will point out here is that these providers that have received these grants thus far would be completely eligible, and it appears that would be competitive in a competitive grant process. The question here, the request here is to require these providers to go through the same competitive grant process that all other grantees have to go through. The impact, though, is that there could essentially be some service reduction, and we're aware of that. There's federal funding for similar services that would continue to be available on a competitive basis through the DHS Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, so we would request that they would go through that competitive process. We'd be taking reductions here to preserve current eligibility levels for CD consolidated funds. And so, if there's questions, I have some more background data on some of these programs as well, if there are specific questions in regards to these.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've got relationships with adjoining states, and so if you live near a border, and it makes more sense for you to get treatment in Hudson or an adjoining state. We've got relationships with the adjoining states on reciprocity and reimbursement. Is this going to screw up any of that, those agreements that we have, or how will those be affected, do you know?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't see that removing this designation for these two programs and then having these providers go through a different RFP process, I don't see how that could complicate that.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm a little concerned with the elimination of the grant process for the prenatal. I think that we've all probably known and identified that, you know, that prenatal care, you know, keeping pregnant women free of alcohol and drugs, alcohol probably more than any other drug, is pretty important. And the kind of culturally specific nature of this, that there's a disproportionate amount of, I think, American Indian women and African American women that we serve with this grant. And so can you talk a little more about how a competitive grant process is going to get the care for that population, that's going to give effective care for that population?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, these are excellent points, and certainly by no means is this a judgment call regarding the quality of these programs or the importance of a methamphetamine program or the prenatal exposure to alcohol program. Essentially, what happens if they go through a competitive grant process? It allows us to provide better supervision, consultation, oversight of the grants, and helping to push providers to reach certain outcome levels that we would hope we could achieve by investing in this kind of investing at this level in these type of programs. So there's a lot of thoughts that have gone back into how do we arrive at that. So do you have more information?
Yeah, Carol Falkowski, Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. In response to your question, we have 13 other grants that are competitive grants funded through our federal block grant that provide support for women and children, including prenatal care. So it's not like that service niche is disappearing. We have a lot of programming focusing on that.
Mr.
Representative Hayden.
I guess what I'm worried about is not necessarily, I mean, I am worried about that service being not being provided, but I'm more, I think, worried about the culturally specific nature of the service being provided, and that often culturally specific agencies have a tendency not to be as large, and thus, I'm inferring, maybe not show up as competitive when they go through the process. So I'm wondering if, in going through the consolidation of making everything competitive and not giving them the grant, would we lose the culturally specific nature of the service for this population?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'll take a stab at trying to answer that. And my response would be that the federal guidelines require granting processes to be very stringent regarding being open to culturally specific programming. So I think that these programs, as we look at them, you know, our review of these programs is that they would be competitive applicants in a competitive process. So it may very well, I can't guarantee this, but it may very well be that there would be no change if they went through a competitive process. But it allows us to have a very finite dollar amount spent and allows us to triage the awarding those grants to those that seem to be best fitting to our priorities and to be the most competitive applicants. I think the question that I'm hearing you ask is, do we run the risk, do we run the risk in this, by eliminating these designated awards to somehow reducing funding to those programs that are more culturally specific than others? And when I look at this, my answer would be no. I don't believe we run the risk of that. Because when we look at how we're awarding these other grants, I think that there's quite an array of cultural specificity in the other grants that have gone out. Now, one thing that I could offer is to provide back to you the approach that we intend to be taking in the competitive review process. We've been asked for that previously as well. We can certainly provide that just so you kind of have some more information about how we approach that.
Representative Hayden. And also, in addition to that, could we get a breakdown of those that are going through the competitive process today versus those that are receiving, the providers that are receiving an allocation through the grant process, just as a matter of comparison, so if we sit here 2 years from now and we talk about this again, we can look at that. I mean, just to make a statement, I'm extremely concerned about the cultural specific nature of the way in which we treat chemical dependency, and I think that I don't want to be lost that we have made some gains in treating people in a culturally specific or even gender specific way in dealing with these issues, and that as we kind of move forward, I want to be sure that that population's needs are getting met, and we've worked awfully hard over, say, the last 30 years that I know in being the leader around culturally and gender-specific treatment. So,
Commissioner. Mr. Chair and Representative, the answer is yes. We can absolutely provide that information to you, and I just want to say that your comments and your concerns are heard and duly noted and appreciated. Thank you.
Representative Hayden, I think the grants are listed in the appendix, page 353.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Abler,
no, right.
We only have about 10 more minutes for right. Dr. Sulik.
Just have to mention the NOCA thing, but Representative Hayden, to that, which actually is working, and you know that. But I think that as we look at all the choices, Representative Hayden and others, we'll have to decide that they had to balance the budgets, and so we get to take a second crack at this later, and maybe we won't pick those to knock out. Okay.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Hayden, just to follow up on your comments, I think when you say you're concerned about the size of the agency and the size of the agency driving the competitive nature of it, I certainly hope that that's not the case. When I look at the needs in the rural areas, in addition to what you're talking about, often it seems as though bigger projects swipe more of the money, and I do think that some of the smaller agencies that are focusing on the needs are of significant concern as well, and so I appreciate your comments. I certainly would also, Commissioner, if you could provide some regional information or some geographical information around the grants in terms of the information that you provided to Representative Hayden, I think that would be appreciated as well. And then my other question was related to the methamphetamine program. When you talk about or when we look at these programs and the need for something to continue going forward, obviously when those were put into place, they were of significant need. It's my understanding that the methamphetamine use has gone down. I'm wondering if there's any reduced use of those programs or if the use is still out there and it's just all talk that the use is going down. What's going on with methamphetamine around the state?
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, I think, first of all, yes, we can certainly provide a geographical distribution list for you so you can see the array of grants that are going out across the state and certainly by region. Secondly, when it comes to the methamphetamine grants, these are, these fit in with the priorities that are currently in existence. I think that if we look at the admissions and we look at the data from these two grant programs that are there, they certainly determine that there's need out there. This is not a statement regarding that the need is somehow dramatically reducing to the point where these funding and this priority does not doesn't exist any longer. So I think that they fit with our priority. I can give you some exact numbers. The Anoka County grant and the other MEP grant is in the Faribault-Martin County. You know, certainly one somewhat rural, one somewhat more urban in the centers. The utilization seems to be that in the Faribault-Martin County grant program, 44% of the grant goes to provide the house where meth-dependent clients live. They've had five clients that have completed the CD treatment program at the Fountain Center there. We don't have, when I looked at these numbers, I can't trend and determine that somehow there's a decrease in the referrals. It seems like that they have programs that they're providing care and they're providing utilization at a fairly consistent rate.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say thank you for your efforts. When I hear you discuss these difficult decisions that your department and the state is going to be making, I hear a lot of pragmatism in trying to make the changes in the areas where there might be other alternatives available. And I think your department and you deserve some credit for trying to offset and minimize the impact to individuals in a negative way. And I just want to say thanks for that, for those efforts. None of these decisions are easy. None of them are fun to make, but there certainly is a layering of programs out there as we try to streamline and make government work better for individuals. I think you guys are making efforts in that direction. I just want to say thanks.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I thank you for your comments, and I just want to thank my staff has been absolutely incredible in this process, and we appreciate the recognition of the painstaking nature of this.
No other questions, Bill. You go ahead.
Well, that brings us, that's the perfect segue, actually, into the next budgetary page, which is page number 124. My impression is that Assistant Commissioner Brian Osberg had postponed the presentation of this page, which was actually in his section, for me to present, because it does involve some consideration of interactions and impacts back on us in state-operated services. So if you turn to page 124, and then I will walk you through the thought process that went into this. Essentially, in regard to trying to come up with our requirements and the demand that we had for budgetary changes to address the deficit, there was a ratable reduction applied across inpatient services. When we looked at that ratable reduction and how it would impact inpatient psychiatric care, we could not justify that we could be continuing to apply the exact same ratable reduction to inpatient psychiatric programs compared to the rest of medical programs. Previously, psychiatric programs have been exempt from ratable reductions because of the vulnerability that's clearly recognized for health systems and small providers as well as large providers in trying to provide inpatient psychiatric care. So we essentially looked at what type of reduction we were required to provide, but we were able to negotiate within the budgetary process to cut that reduction for psychiatric units in half to what it was proposed for the other units. Now, that still leads to a significant reduction in payments to inpatient psychiatric providers across the state. As we examine the expected rise in need for services, given the current times and the current forecasting that we're doing when it looking at psychiatric utilization needs, we are anticipating, because specifically of some reduction in capacity, that there would be an increase in commitments. And there would be an increase in emergency referrals back to the state-operated services system, back into the ANOCA facility, as well as the 10 community behavioral hospitals. So the action that's proposed here is that mental health services have a ratable reduction equal to about 6%, as opposed to about 12%, which applies to other areas of medicine. This ends up saving $21.5 million for the biennium. There was $4.7 million here added in as an additional cost identified that, due to the increased utilization of the community-based hospital beds based on commitments and emergency admissions over and above our current capacity. We currently have capacity within these hospital beds. You look at total bed capacity and utilization of those beds. So we forecasted in what is our capacity to accommodate an increase in demand. We forecasted over and above the type of way that we tried to come up with a model that would allow us to determine at what point we might see an increase in commitments back on us, try to forecast that out so that we can take into account that additional potential expense. That is what's being presented here. The impact of this is there's a significant contribution towards the budget deficit by this saving, yet we're also well aware that there's a significant loss to potential community capacity because psychiatric providers are vulnerable. They probably have the lowest rate of investment or return on investment than probably any other area in all of healthcare. And so we recognize that our inpatient psychiatric care providers are really vulnerable when we include them in this ratable reduction. We therefore have to see our role in the state as continuing to provide a portion of the safety net and recognize that we need to step up and be willing and able and ready to accommodate a rise in referrals back on us as our community providers are expected to reduce their overall capacity to provide uncompensated care
and even overall care because of this.
Commissioner, what was the dollar amount that State Operated Services is going to increase?
It's projected that over the biennium, Mr. Chair, the State Operated Services would increase $4.7 million in new additional funding over and above our current appropriation. And that would be specific to the adult mental health care system within State Operated Services.
For the biennium. And then, it's about $17 million in savings, but you've already subtracted that 4.7 out of that.
Correct.
Okay. Any further questions, or this is the last change page that you have, right?
Mr. Chair, no, we have several others, but I understand the time frame, and we're prepared to come back if you need us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and I will say that I think that 4.7 increase in spending is the first one I've seen where the department has actually put some of the costs into the budget, because these people don't go away when you provide services. They're still here, and somebody's going to take care of them. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Dr. Sulik, and we're going to move on then to an overview of the mental health system. I'm going to start with Sue Adderholden from MAMI and Kathy Kelso.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sue Adderholden. I'm the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness, and also co-chairing along with Kathy the Mental Health Legislative Network. We were asked to pretty much provide an overview of the mental health system in 10 minutes. And so in order to talk not too fast, what we did is we created a chart. So I'd ask that you put the chart out in front of you. Basically, mental illness, of course, is caused by a number of factors, biology, genetics, neurochemical. There are risk factors involved. It could also involve abuse and neglect and trauma. It affects, of course, all ages, all socioeconomic groups, although people who live in poverty are at greater risk of developing a mental illness. It affects all political parties. It really affects, everyone. And I think that's an important part to point out. Next, in terms of looking at how do people...
Mr. Abraham, yes. Which political party does it hurt the worst?
I'm not at liberty to say. The next row really is kind of your entree into the mental health system. And so what it really starts with is, frankly, insurance. So some people have private health insurance, through their... particularly their employers, that provides one entree into the mental health system. Some people are on public health insurance, which of course have a wide range of eligibility criteria. You've got Minnesota Care, medical assistance, general assistance, medical care, Medicare, and Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association as well. Then you have people who are what we call underinsured. This was particularly more true before the Mental Health Parity Act was passed, but remember that doesn't fully go into play until 2010. And even so, we're looking at kind of a different form of health insurance that is being provided by many employers. So you might have very high deductibles, limited benefits, benefit caps, big spend downs, that type of thing. And then you have people who don't have any health insurance. If you look at the next row, it's kind of a listing of providers. Under A, you've got basically kind of what I would call private providers primary care physicians who are actually probably the largest provider of mental health services. You've got your psychiatrists, psychologists, licensed clinical social workers, that type of thing. Under B, you've got what I would consider more of your public mental health providers and more intensive services. You have your community mental health centers, inpatient hospitalization, day treatment, partial hospitalization, state-operated services like your state hospitals and the CABs. County staff actually provide mental health services as well, your contract beds, your residential treatment for both adults and kids, and then crisis homes. If you look at C, you've got more of your community supports. Adult rehab mental health services, we call them ARMS, CTSS, Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, your ACT teams, your community support programs. You might think about your drop-in centers, your clubhouses, case management and care coordination, crisis services, particularly the mobile crisis services, foster care, respite care, behavioral health aides, personal care assistants, and then there's other things like homemakers and telemedicine. Over on the far right, they aren't really part of the mental health system, but they really help people in terms of recovery and being able to live well in the community. You have your schools, which for children are really important. You have employment, which we actually know helps people recover, whether it's through Voc Rehab, the extended employment program for people with serious mental illness, or your basic EE, and other types of supported employment. And then the housing. Bridges Housing, which I know many of you are familiar with, that kind of supplements people before they get eligible for Section 8, the Crisis Housing Fund, group residential housing, board and lodge, nursing homes, and the lodge model. So people kind of can do all those things. On the little funding box, which is in the gray color, I think what you can see is when you look at the private mental health providers, if you're on regular private insurance, you're going to be accessing all of those kind of providers. You will get a couple of the intensive providers in the middle. Very few private plans will pay for anything under C. And most of the people who are listed under A as a private mental health provider, they're going to get, you know, private insurance, some public health insurance, although, as you know, we have people who won't take medical assistance, so that would, you know, clearly restrict people there. And then, of course, out-of-pocket. Under B, while certainly hospitals and partial hospitalization take private insurance, they generally tend to have a greater proportion of people who are on public insurance, so on medical assistance or Minnesota Care. I will just point out that under Minnesota Care, about a third of those people actually utilize mental health services. Also under, especially if you look at the community mental health centers, because they take both a lot of public insurance, underinsured and no health insurance, they will use a sliding fee and often are supplemented by county funds to make sure that they are available. And then many of these programs also get funding through United Way. They look for foundation money and do their own fundraising, bake sales, you know, whatever, in order to keep our doors open.
If you look at the Roland, could you go back? You say that 30% or a third of the Minnesota Care enrollees use mental health services?
That's correct. 30%. They tend to be not the most intensive services. And I think you could say that perhaps it's because of that, that they're able to access their medications, therapy, ARM services, that type of thing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And then under C, those community supports, for instance, ARM services are almost totally funded by public health programs. So your medical assistance, your Minnesota Care, there are sometimes some county funds in there. There are a few private health insurance companies that cover that, but not all. And a lot of these really do depend on county funds. CSTs in particular are greatly funded by county funds. And again, you're looking at United Way foundations and fundraising. I hope this kind of helps a little bit if you think about it. So me with my private insurance, I'm going to be able to access the psychiatrist, counselors, the therapists, that type of thing, inpatient hospitalization. The young man who testified yesterday in the Senate, he is on medical assistance and Medicare, so he has a psychiatrist and he has a therapist, but he also receives ARM services, which are funded by medical assistance. So I hope, and there's no easy way to do this, but I think that this at least kind of helps you see where people fall into play here. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to turn it over to Kathy to talk about the impact of the economy and all of this.
Representative Root,
thank you, Mr. Chair. This is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I have an easy question. Probably I should know the answer, but I don't. What does EE stand for under the vocational rehab and then also the EESMS?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Root, it stands for extended employment and extended employment for people with serious mental illness.
Thank you.
It was too long to put on. We didn't have paper that was longer than this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Kelso. I'm with the Mental Health Association, and I have the opposite side of the page, the doom and the gloom. During this economic time, we've been hearing a lot from folks about how with the economy, there's an increase in stress, depression, anxiety, and loss of employment. And with the loss of employment, often means the loss of insurance, if there is any insurance at all. Excuse me while I cough. Excuse me. So during this budget crisis, we're looking at a loss of insurance, perhaps an increase in public insurance, if it's available, Minnesota Care, GAMC. More pressure on providers in the B and the C categories. That means public assistance supported providers due to more uncompensated care and cuts in payment rates. And with the loss of access to health insurance, you have loss of medication. This in turn might exacerbate symptoms. And then you have to seek treatment, which may not be available. And you have loss of community support due to a decrease in funding and therefore a decrease in the number of jobs. You have a decrease in the ability for people to manage care. So we see children and adults deteriorating. We see increase in homelessness. We see perhaps an increased use of the criminal justice system. We see perhaps increased hospitalization, a higher level of service use paid for under medical assistance. And if indeed folks are committed, then they're going to see a loss of job, a loss of housing perhaps, an increased inability to actually secure housing and sometimes jobs if you have a civil commitment on your record. All of this loss actually can translate into increased costs for the entire economy. It doesn't stimulate the economy, it actually depresses the economy. And the one page that was pointed out at the very end of Commissioner Sula's testimony on page 124 about the increased demand, that is an unnecessary increased demand on services. It's not as if these are consumers seeking to be civilly committed because the previous supports in the community were no longer there, they might find themselves in this situation. So the increased demand is sort of artificial demand, if you will. So difficulty in accessing all these services can actually have a much higher toll on the individual and on the community for which he comes.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add one thing that you had mentioned earlier. No one moves off of the page. They're going to move somewhere onto this page. And so if they're not in the boxes in terms of mental health services, you'll see on the bottom, you know, where we have homeless, you know, jails, prisons, that type of thing. So nobody moves off the page. They're going to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? Representative Slowick.
Mr. Chair, and to either one of you, you know, day after day we're in this committee and we hear about the governor's proposals and what they've probably spent months and months and months working on. The longer I sit here, I think we really don't have to do any of this. You know, we really could come up with our own plan and do something else. So you probably can't articulate what your plan would be. But do you have an alternative vision, or are you going to be presenting one or talking to, maybe you're meeting with us separately about why we don't have to do these and what else we could do? We're going to have to do something, clearly. Something, clearly.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallach, I think that's right, the $1 million question that is here and that all of us are trying to struggle with. I think that what we would like to see is not to get rid of what I would consider the way for people to access services. I think eliminating Minnesota Care will be an incredible injustice and will really force many people to go without treatment and medications and lose their jobs and lose, you know, their homes. I think that would have a terrible impact, frankly. I think that we would like to make sure that the community services that people really depend on to live well and to stay out of the high-end services, that those are preserved and that we don't lose some of our providers. You know, I think if you look at particularly Box B, you know, those are folks who rely heavily on public funding. The community mental health centers rely heavily on county and state funding. And so they're going to be hardest hit if by the 3% cut, because it's not like they're making it up with private insurance in any way. We're working hard within the Mental Health Legislative Network to try to find some ways to squeeze here, nip there without really destroying our system. We realize that that's an important thing to do, but I think I would speak for all of our organizations by saying that we have always supported an increase in revenue as a way to weather through some of these really bad times.
Okay, we're, yeah.
And I just think, very briefly, the Legislative Network has also discussed that state-operated services should really be the last resort, not the first resort. I think redirecting some funding into state-operated services may actually not be the most cost-efficient use of our money.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your presentation. And next we have Dr. Gordy Alexander and Kathy Knight.
Good afternoon, Representative Huntley and committee members. I appreciate this. I'm Gordy Alexander, president of the University of Minnesota Medical Center, part of Fairview Health Services. UMMC is a large teaching hospital with 7,000 inpatient admissions for mental health and chemical dependency. We care for adolescents, adults, and children with behavioral needs. Last year, we had 2,000 inpatient admissions for children under the age of 18 alone. go off script a little here. I'll tell you that several years ago, several of us got together at Minnesota Healthcare Action Group. Sue Abderholden was part of it. The department was part of it. And the discussion around mental health is much better than it was several years ago. And thank you for all your participation in that and legislative efforts over the years. I think my job here after the eloquent discussion of the past several speakers is to really emphasize the unintended consequences of some of these actions. I think the commissioner talked about one issue that's frequently not well understood, the whole idea about need for behavioral beds. We have plenty of beds. We don't have enough psychiatrists. So I think that taking a deep dive into the topic as you are doing today is something that the state should be very thankful of or for. Before I get too deep into the details of financing, I want to tell you about John. John was hospitalized a few months ago at University of Minnesota Medical Center, UMMC, as we talked about it. Too long of a name. He had a suicide attempt. He's 44-year-old, father of four, has a job. His wife works, too. They have health insurance. When John left our care, he went home with medications. Outpatient services were scheduled, all the things that were needed to provide him support to manage his depression at home and in his community. Weeks later, John called Maggie, one of our mental health care workers. Maggie helped set up his discharge plan, make all the arrangements for community services, but then John lost his insurance. Family was 5 months behind on their mortgage, without money and insurance coverage. John was no longer able to see his local psychiatrist. You can see what's happening. Prescriptions were running out, didn't know what to do. We tried to help all the usual pathways. Social services in his county, there's 2.5 months wait to be seen. John wasn't under our care anymore, but we still made calls and tried to help him get drugs. Challenges continue. Unfortunately, the story doesn't have a neat and happy ending. And unfortunately, there are many people like John. Despite Maggie's valiant efforts and all the work that Sue talked about in her list, there aren't enough Maggies to overcome the challenges and shortcomings of our system. And unfortunately, and even as the department acknowledged, we perhaps are making things worse, not better. The cost that we think we're saving will push back elsewhere. As Sue talked about, mental health services are financed in a very complex way. Fairview, who is it probably as large a provider of mental health services as there is other than the government providers. Medicaid and Medicare have a big influence. 59% of our patients receive care from one of those two payers. We had in 2007, those two payers accounted for a $7 million loss. So this is not a service we provide because it's a great business case. We do it because it's a needed business to provide care for these unfortunate folks. However, whenever we lose money in these services, the money has to be taken from somebody else or services have to be cut. We're in the midst of a large impact of across the entire Fairview of $100 million over 2 years. So we can't just pass the plum as it might be suggested. Our reimbursement is greatly influenced by how long patients stay. A lot of these services that are cut will force more people to stay in the hospital a longer time. That not only is care that is increasingly challenged because of the length of time they are out of their community, we do not receive any more money just because they stay a longer time. So the impact starts snowballing of these very complex patients. patients with serious and persistent mental illness, such as those with schizophrenia and bipolar illness with psychosis, cannot be challenged for weeks and or months. We lose money on every case. 27% of our mental health inpatients remain in the hospital for 10 patients or longer. Just this group of patients accounts for a loss of $3.6 million annually. Sometimes patients stay too long because the right community-based services can't be found or because the waiting list for regional treatment centers is extremely long. We can't safely discharge patients unless we can secure appropriate services like psychiatry, supportive living arrangements, and more. This is a very complex problem, obviously, but frequently there are unexpected and untoward consequences of our short-term cuts. As Sue outlined in the bottom of her page, jails frequently take our treatment failures. You know, acute care hospitals have become the safety net for the most seriously mentally ill and poorly resourced patients in our community. This is inappropriate care for those patients when they are forced outside of the hospitals in an untimely way or into the hospitals because they can't get services elsewhere. We have to offset these losses elsewhere. Our patients are facing difficult decisions. A young man named Ryan started our adolescent outpatient treatment program for drug use. While in treatment, Ryan's mom lost her job and insurance is not uncommon among these families that are challenged. While Ryan was doing well in the program, mom became concerned that she could no longer afford the care, even with the assistance from us. She made the tough decision to withdraw from the program. Ryan went back to his high school and again began to succumb to his addiction. He's now facing legal trouble and is in the juvenile justice system. We have other stories. I'm sure it would not surprise you. These are tough times, and we have to collectively wrestle with the challenge we face. I understand closing a $5 billion or now $7 billion state shortfall is going to require tough decisions, but I really hope that we can consider the short-term and long-term consequences of our decisions, the unintended ones. We invest now or pay later. Ryan's story is an unfortunate but honest reality. Certainly, the acknowledgement of the department that we have to make sure we don't lose federal dollars is just one effort. I also think we do need to consider alternative revenue sources. Kathy or I will be happy to answer any questions. I think this has been illuminating, sobering, But again, I do want to thank the committee and its work on behalf of the mentally ill over the past several years. I think we do have a public partnership that can work, is in the process of fixing itself, and we at Fairview remain active and willing partners. Thank you.
Questions? No, I don't see any, and we're out of time, so thank you very much for your
thank
presentation.
You.
Meeting is adjourned.